You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to New World Pictures Podcast. We're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me always is Mark.
I'm still here.
And Erica.
Hanging on by a thread, guys.
And we have an incredible interview for you, folks. We're so excited because we have been able to talk with writers, directors, actors, but we have been wanting for a while to speak with some of the executives who worked at New World Pictures, particularly the New World Pictures that followed Corman's era. We have finally got an interview for you. We have Jonathan Wolf. He was the CFO of New World International. And boy, what an education this interview is. We've been talking about New World Pictures for years now, and I feel like I have a good sense of both eras a little bit, but this is really such a great insight into how studios work, what they were focused on, the demands that studios have to so many different people. It was like, I thought I knew it. And then we started talking with Jonathan. I was like, wow, I'm learning a whole lot here because I didn't know. I thought I knew and I didn't. We're going to talk a little bit about certainly about what he did there, how he got into New World, what he did at the company and the goals of the company. And I think he's got some really interesting insights into the goals of the second ownership group of New World. So let's get into it. Here's our interview with Jonathan Wolf.
But you started working at CBS for...
Yeah, a couple of years at Deloitte. And then, you know, my background was finance. So a couple of years at Deloitte and then 6 years at CBS, eventually in LA, San Francisco, back to LA, then New York. It was sort of see CBS, join the world. Join CBS, see the world. But I ended up in New York as a director of finance for CBS Broadcast International, which was the division that distributed all of the CBS-owned content globally. And so that is what ended up leading me to New World later.
Were you trying to sell CBS shows to like international vendors?
That's basically what the division did. It was all the international licensing, including planes. American Airlines back then would get a CBS News tape on every plane by 7 a.m. around the country. So that back, you know, the technology is very different. So they could play CBS morning, the news in the morning as people were leaving. But it was all the licensing of shows. I mean, most of the shows that CBS had, they only licensed the domestic rights. They didn't own the shows, but a lot of the sports they did, CBS was licensing the NBA, for example, globally. But it was, you know, an interesting operation. But just like New World, CBS continued at that point to go through a whole bunch of iterations as well.
So how did your transition go from CBS to New World?
Well, after a couple of years in New York, I realized that brainwashing actually did exist in this world, and it existed in New York City, in the city of Manhattan, where everybody said this is the greatest place to live in the world. And one day when I was sitting, I think I was on the C train coming into Columbus Circle, and the train had stopped on the track because another train was there, and we happened to be on a track with no electricity, and it went dark, and there was no air conditioning, and it was the middle of the summer. The windows were open. I was hot. The handle was damp, and I didn't know it was condensation or the person before me sweat, and somebody was breathing on my neck. I didn't know whether to be happy about it or not. I just decided at that point, this guy from L.A. needed to go back, and I promised that if I made it back to L.A., I wouldn't always search for the closest parking spot. I'd be happy to walk a block away. But it was just time for me going to, you know, CBS in New York was like grad school. It was a great couple of years, learned a lot, saw a lot, came back to LA, and within a very short period of time, landed at New World.
And you were at the same position the entire time you were at New World, or where did you?
I was brought in as a director overseeing finance in their international operations, and about 6 months later was a VP, and then stayed as VP and CFO of their international division, which at the time was about $150 million a year in revenue. You know, New World at that time was sort of like Lionsgate today,
Yeah.
And so
Interestingly, run by someone who used to work for New World Television.
that well, John
Yeah, John.
Feldheimer. Yeah, I knew John loosely. I mean, we'd crossed paths in some meetings, but not a lot. He was totally focused on the production side.
Sure. So you're brought in though to work on the international side. So were you licensing films? What was
Well,
your
my role was overseeing the mechanics of the, or the finance operation. The international division had four offices: LA, New York, London, and Sydney. We were doing direct distribution in the UK and in Australia, licensing the rest of the world. 30 films a year, 8 hours of primetime television, including two soap operas. You know, it was the Wonder Years days, and so there was just a tremendous amount of volume. And many of the deals that New World did back then were slate deals with TBA Pictures, th 30 films to the German distributor. With here are the first five and the other 30, you know, 25 or are TBAs, of which there'd be different tranches. You know, a certain tranche for one budget level, a certain for another. Two or three would have A-list actors. You know, there'd be definitions of this, and then frequently we'd underdeliver or we'd want to overdeliver, and we'd have to renegotiate. And that's where I'd get involved in some of those deals in terms of sitting with the distributors and, you know, talking about how are we going to change the deal, especially when New World started, you know, closing down the film division under Perlman, and some of those output deals weren't going to be filled. And so, do we get into the issue of breach? Do we get into the issue of negotiated settlement? Things like that. But it was really the business activities of the international side. The sales guys were doing the licensing, the production guys were doing, you know, making the films. And someone basically watched out for everything else.
And that's where you came in, right?
Right. And that's really a CFO's role. I mean, you know, there's the financial planning piece of that. It's a public company. You've got to be delivering financials at the right time. But that really wasn't the core of what the international side needed. It was, I say, it was a very electric time at the moment. The amount of volume that was going through there. And given the sheer, you know, smallness of the division, it was just there were 10-hour days all the time, but exciting times. It was just constantly win, win, win. Not to take a Trump phrase away, but that's really how it felt.
Yeah. So you're involved in like moving like the movies that New World's making overseas or also and also the acquisitions that you're talking about, those TBA deals. Was that
Well,
like because they
if
were
we talk
making
about.
a there was a tremendous amount of product, not only that, with New World Video at the time, which starts in 1985.
Well, if we talk about the company as a whole, not necessarily, you know, my role specifically, I think maybe taking a step back, because this iteration of New World from about 1983, when Larry Kupin and Harry Sloan, you know, got a hold of the company, technology had inserted itself into the industry in a manner that it probably had never done before, meaning cable was brand new with an insatiable appetite, video stores. Nobody drove by one video store to go to the next. You always went to your closest. So every video store had to have one of everything. Everything. New World would make a TV movie and then the next month ship 50,000 VHS cassettes of something that had already been on television simply because no store could be missing something. Everybody had to have one of everything. And it was almost a little too easy. But what Sloan and Kupin and Roger Burlidge and even Bob Ramey, and they were really the key architects of this at different time frames for between 83 and 90. What they all knew was this. There are two kinds of production distribution companies. Those that produce so they can continue to distribute, and those that distribute so that they can continue to produce. New World was of that first group. They were a distribution company. And just like oil companies, if you said to Chevron or Unocal or whoever, we'll give you an endless supply of oil, they'd all get out of the exploration business tomorrow. It's high risk, it's all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
They're at their core, they're refiners. The only reason they keep looking for oil is because they've got to continue to refine. Well, The studios are the same way. If you look at the majors, these are distribution companies. They produce to keep the distribution going. Well, in the 80s, when all this money was coming out of Wall Street, because they were seeing this huge bubble of V created by VHS and created by cable, there were producers that created distribution operations so they could continue to produce. Dino De Laurentiis, Jerry Weintraub, a couple of others were able to raise money in Wall Street, but their interest really wasn't distribution. It was so that they would have an outlet for the films they wanted to make. And those are probably both, I mentioned a couple larger ones. There are a lot of mid-sized and smaller ones where producers raised money and just they were gone in 3 to 5 years because their reason to exist, and what's that French phrase, raison d'être, I can't pronounce it right. Their reason to exist was production. Kuppen and Sloan, they weren't movie guys. They were business guys. They were distribution guys. The reason New World existed during that period, again, 83 to 90, was to be a distribution company. And so everything about the culture of the company, yes, the producing side, they were happy about their films. They were excited. They were invested. But the culture of the company ultimately was as a distributor from top to bottom. It was about the deals, about the economics. You know, how are you going to buy the film? How many can we get out into the marketplace? And that was really what everyone was focused on, and it drove all the decisions.
But they did start to pick up like a lot of movies as well.
Absolutely, because acquisitions is funding the is filling the distribution pipeline, just like the oil company. If New World could have stopped producing because they were guaranteed spec films, 30 films a year at a revenue point, they'd stop. I mean, you know, obviously that would never happen. I'll give you an example. There's a film I think you covered in one of your podcasts, because I remember reading something, The Killing Time with Kiefer Sutherland. A close friend of mine, Robert Levy, was one of the producers. His company's Tapestry Films. That I don't think I'm saying anything out of school now. Film was produced for $1,000,001. They raised that $1,000,001 privately. In 1987, they're producing a film for $1,000,001 with private money, and that was doable back then, with no distribution at all. If you said in today's dollars, here we are almost 40 years later, can you raise $1,000,000 for a spec film that you're not going to show to a distributor till it's completely done? People look at you like you were crazy. Back then, it was doable because there was such an insatiable appetite from distributors, and because whether it was, you know, Showtime competing against HBO in the UK, remember BSB and Sky were two different companies. They hadn't merged yet. They reach out bidding the other, and all the video stores. And so, Tapestry, they made The Killing Time, and I set up the acquisition screening at New World. And a New World eventually bought the film for about 10% over what the producers, you know, what it cost to make the film after producing fees and all of that. That ended up, by the way, for Tapestry, they had an investor, Rick Guerin, J.P. Guerin, very wealthy guy who just died a few years ago. He said, "Hey, gee, this is a business we can actually make money." And he ended up backing and being a partner in Tapestry for the next 35 years. Their next film, about 3 years later, was the original Point Break. They went on to produce all of the Olsen Twin videos. They did Wedding Crashers, and so. But that was their The Killing Time was their first film. But I only mention it because it's my former business partner and who is president of New World domestic distribution and marketing would say to me back then, you could make a movie about a kid sitting in a corner staring at its navel for an hour and a half and still make a profit in the mid-80s. That it was just really difficult to make a film that was going to lose money. You really had to screw it up. And so if you made things that were actually commercially interesting, you know, then you did even better. Of course, that's an exaggeration and people did lose money on certain films, but it was much easier than it was later because there was this bubble of, again, cable and video just chasing everything.
And it was lucrative to try to then to license it out to cable networks and then also release it on New World Video or that kind of
Well, that
thing, at
was the
least.
business. Paul Kolberg ran the video division. I remember, you talk about numbers, and I'm a numbers person. Remember talking to Bob Ramey one day, and he was president of the company after Roger Burledge left, and he said, I asked three different people how a video did that they distributed, and I got three different answers, and they were all correct. Because one quoted units, one quoted wholesale revenue, and one quoted retail revenue. Everybody's focus was different, but it was all on, depending on where you were sitting and what metric was important to you, it was all on the revenue side. So, when it was head of acquisition, Walter Calmette was head of acquisitions, and he's the one that acquired The Killing Time. His mandate was simply find films, look at it, and determine on a distribution basis, can we make money on it? So yes, everything for New World is about putting it out through their own video distribution, the international division, obviously active at all the film markets, pushing out a lot of films. 60% easily of New World's film revenue came outside the US. The TV revenue was a bit of a flip because of the licensing deals. There's a little more on the domestic side, but back then, even New World was a $400 to $500 million a year company. It was all about the revenue. Again, that I'm repeating myself, but that was the culture. This is a revenue focused company, not a production focused company.
In fact, that was when we talked to Roger Burledge. One of the things he was kind of, he would say he would get frustrated with was because they continued to up the budgets of the movies without trying, and he had
What
a very
for? Roger
right.
was instrumental in me coming to New World. The president of New World International, Bill Shields, he had been president of global distribution, both domestic and international. And it got so big that he felt that one person really couldn't do it justice. And he, at the end of 1986, stepped away from the domestic to be president of the international only. And recommended a close friend of his, Robert Sharon, Bob Sharon, who was at the time president of marketing distribution for Orion. He set up the connection with New World, and Bob Sharon left Orion at the end of '86 in New York, came to LA to head the domestic side. And so, when we talk about that revenue stream, even the people in that business in that area, as president of the division, Bill would even say it's gotten too big for one person to give it what it needs, and he split it. And so Roger was instrumental in coming because he had said to Bill, "You need someone not at the corporate accounting area. You need someone in a financial operations area looking after this." That's what ended up with me landing at New World.
It's, did you work with Roger? Did you interview with him, with Roger Burledge, when you
I
came in,
know
or?
I came into New World in the late fall of '86, and Roger left at the end of '86 when his contract was up. I think when Bob Ramey came in, and I never sensed any difficulty or animosity with any of the key players. I think Roger just looked at this and said, my role was really to get this company up and going and get it public. He was key in taking the company public. And once he was there, with Kuppen and Sloan as co-chairman having that role, and Bob Ramey coming in as president to really give the company industry cred, it sort of there wasn't the right place for Roger. I think he's ready for a new challenge, and there wasn't. And again, you talked to him. I know Roger. If I saw him, walking down the street, we'd say hello and chat. We've talked many times. I didn't interview with him, but he was key with me coming in.
I mean, as you were saying, the business was growing. I mean, I'm wearing this Godzilla 1985 shirt, and we talked to Tony Randall, and they talked about how many they sold, so many of that on videotape in 1985. Like, it had a small run in theaters, but video, it absolutely blew up. It was huge. So there was it the business was definitely in flux, I think, around that time, and that must have been frustrating for Roger and to that degree.
And Kuppen and Sloan, they they always had a plan to exit. I don't think they ever viewed themselves as we're gonna, be moguls that are gonna build a 20-year business. It was we're gonna set this up, we're gonna get it big enough, and then we're gonna have an exit strategy. And they rode the bubble, basically. They rode that mid to late 80s bubble, and they stepped out, credit to them at the right time.
Yeah, you were talking about Robert Remy coming in and sort of bringing industry cred. Now, he had worked initially at New World back in the 1970s in their distribution departments, but he had gone on to work for Avco, Embassy, and I think Universal as well.
Was
And he
president
had.
of Universal, and even more important than that, he was president of the Academy for 5 terms, 5 years. That's an elite, note on your CV. And so he came in, and I think that also boosted New World's credibility. Remember, they weren't facing primarily Hollywood. If they could write a check, you don't have to have credibility. They were facing Wall Street. And Bob Ramey brought in that level of credibility. It wasn't a ragtag operation that might fall apart tomorrow. You got this guy who was president of the Academy as president, and that means someone who's well respected.
Wasn't he also there to be more, as you're saying, Harry and Larry were kind of looking at this as being a short-term thing. Were they looking for Bob to kind of take over the kind of choices of movies they made and the kind of deals they
Probably.
made with artists?
I wasn't in those meetings, but and I don't know at what level where authority and green light stood and didn't. But I know that, let's say, with the Killing Time film was $1.1 million. Walter Calmette was VP of acquisitions. He said, "I'm buying the film." He told Bob Sharon, acquisitions reported to distribution. Remember, it doesn't report to production. Said, "Hey, I'm buying this film." He said, "Okay, it wasn't seen by anybody else." So there were approval authorities well into the millions that even were below Bob Ramey. So where his role was in the economics, where Sloan and Kupan were, I don't know. I think they started, in the late 80s to focus heavily on the television side, but I don't know where they spent their time and what happened in those meetings, and where approval authorities to green light, stopped.
That's
But
interesting. That's
I mean,
that.
Bob wasn't there as a figurehead. Don't get me wrong. He's one of the sweetest guys in the world. He's terrific. I benefited just by being around him because you learn how to be a leader, and do it the right way. And so he's a terrific guy. But I just don't know each of their individual roles.
Sure. But I like when we talked before we set this whole interview up, you talked about how you hadn't seen many New World movies, which I thought was really amazing. And I love that. That actually made me go, no, we have to talk to you because you were so on the side in the business side, you weren't even worried about the product. But did you had to have seen The Killing Time or some of the movies that you were involved in
I saw The
acquiring.
Killing Time, and I saw it during that acquisition screening. What's interesting is Walter, the head of acquisitions, was about to get up about a third of the way through. He was bored. And I actually said, "Walter, sit down. All of the movie is in the back half." And of course, it got a lot better. Kiefer Sutherland's line, I still remember it. It's something like, "We're having fun now," and he's out in the desert with the gun up like this.
Yeah, it's in
Oh, it is.
the
Okay. Now I saw that, but it's like I saw a tr an R tra an R a Red Band trailer for Hellraiser, where I'm not a horror guy, and so when I see someone starting to get hit in the head with a hammer. And I this no and so no I you know it 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 I can't remember how many New World films I've seen, but it's got to be less than 5 or 6.
That's awesome,
So
actually. That's
but
amazing.
it's Bob Sharon, I mean, he's responsible for marketing. I mean, he did all the Woody Allen films up through 1980 86. When he came to New World, he said, "It's just a movie. Where's the next one?" And they were setting these up with 300 print releases, throughout the country to then set up the video so it'd be legitimate, in that way.
So it's sort of
make
like a
sure that.
shorter run release that would just get enough press that when you put it on video, it would have.
And enough marketing. You know, back then, again, the whole way of distributing films was so different. I mean, back then, New World had 15 or 16 domestic distribution offices around the country because that's how you had to distribute. You know, you had all these mid-sized distributors. They hadn't consolidated like they had today. You know, I mentioned two things in terms of technology with VHS and a cable. The other item that can't be missed in this discussion, and it's part of that bubble, is the multiplex. Before the early 80s, theater bookers were film buffs. They knew the films, they knew the cinematographers. They had to make big choices. If they were going to book a theater for 4 weeks and had 1,000 seats, like the Westwood Village Theater, 1,100 seats, and they were wrong, they had this empty battleship just sitting there and huge losses. The multiplex reduced and almost eliminated risk for the exhibitor because they could scale. Big film, you got five screens. Small film, you get one screen. I mean, I'm simplifying the process. So, which meant, just like the video store, they could take one of everything. They could promise everybody at least a week. And then if it didn't work, you move things around. They became programmers rather than really acquisition people. So the whole job of the film buyer changed dramatically. You actually didn't need to know a lot about the film. Now the questions were, how many prints and what's your marketing budget? Those were the two metrics that the acquisition guys, the film bookers would look at. How many prints? What's your budget? Who's the closest you're going to have to my screens? What's my zone? And so New World was able to release everything. And the multiplex allowed that. So the multiplex allowed every film to get out. The video stores had this appetite. They had to have one of everything. HBO and cable and Showtime were competing against each other. Output deals were a big deal. They all had to lock up film because back then, HBO and Showtime, they didn't have series. It was all about who had the best films fast enough. And so,
When you sell stuff internationally, you're selling both the stuff that from New World Video and also what they're releasing domestically into multiplexes. Are you just channeling all that out?
Everything when New World acquired film, New World acquired global rights. Yeah, there'd be some acquisitions which would be international only or domestic only, but it just wasn't worth it. If you were going to release a film domestically, it ups its international value. You want to participate in that as well. So the Killing Time is sort of a vanilla example of a film being acquired. We get all rights, period. And so, yes, we're putting them in theaters internationally, we're putting in video internationally, we're putting domestic, you know, in television syndication. You know, we forget about that. Syndication was a big deal for these films. Our international TV, you know, we want 20 films, we want five Westerns, we want four action adventures. They're all running at 11:30 at night. So the syndication buyers in Italy were a key thing. The syndication buyers in Germany, all these layers of distribution, it was much, much more complex than it is now. Where once it lands on a platform, it's there forever. Back then, you know, you had independent TV stations that were buying slates of films. And like I said, they'd want a certain kind of mix. And so the films would be packaged. They'd be packaged and sold. You know, the trade show NATPE, I mean, it's gone now, but it used to be the place for selling domestic syndication. And there'd be similar shows at MIP and MIPCOM in France where you do the same thing. So this is all about packaging and finding the right way to license these films. So yes, everything that New World handled, there were some films that probably New World only had international domestic rights, but I would say 80% of their content at least was global. And so the plan of how to release and how to segue, because even the international division, when we would do creative, and you'd come back with comps for a poster, and domestic would limit it down. You know, you go through a few rounds, you get down to your top five, and you take, you know, three to color and one you go with. Domestic would then turn over to international and say, here are our top three. International would finish the top three, and they'd go to different countries and give them their local distributor the choice, because the culture is very different. You need to market this as an action adventure, a horror comedy. Do you want to put the horror up front or the comedy? Which star is going to work in your country more than the other? I mentioned Woody Allen before because of Bob Sharon. Woody Allen's a superstar in France and can't get arrested in Germany. So the artwork and the marketing are going to change. So domestic would work with international. Domestic would take the lead on the first cut, but international would then take elements and recreate different campaigns available. Remember, it was a local distributor that's ending up spending the dough and deciding how to distribute in their territory. But to provide them choices in terms of the creative comps was a big deal. And this is something that a domestic distributor who's investing in that domestic marketing, you can afford to do. Then you'd find a foreign sales agent who's just trying to put something together for foreign. Their budget is much smaller. They don't have all the choices. So when you have the foreign buyer coming to a company like New World, they're not just getting the film, they're getting a lot broader marketing campaign and elements. They're also getting to tout the domestic release. You take a sales agent who's going to, let's say, Cannes or AFM to sell a film, and they say, "What's the domestic plan?" "We don't know yet, but we're pre-selling the film before it's made." "Well, let me know what happens." New World shows up and says, "What's the domestic plan?" "Before the film is made, we're going with 300 prints. We're doing this and this, and this is a guarantee, and we'll put it in your acquisition contract. So when you buy the film for Germany, you're guaranteed that there's a theatrical release in the US at this level." Because remember, stuff is still global, and how the film plays in the US still spills over to the rest of the world. So a company like New World on the international side had a much bigger advantage pre-selling films. Again, pre-selling is selling a film before it's been made. It helps with the financing. It also tests the marketplace to make sure that the film is actually going to be viable. New World had a big advantage because we would put in our contracts for the foreign buyers a guarantee of what the US distribution plan would look like. And that made a difference for them.
Do you recall like any particular titles, could be the TV or that did even better like internationally than it did domestically?
I apologize, but no.
It's fine. It's fine. I thought I would ask.
I'm sure there were horror always plays well internationally. Films that in general, comedies would have done worse, and horror and action adventure better. Things that require that don't rely so heavily on the translation to convey the story. Comedy is very difficult. Unless it's sight gags, but if it's based on jokes, you're in trouble.
Yeah, like I for like on the TV side, I imagine like a crime story or a tour of duty would be an easier international sell than like Santa Barbara, which I know was a big deal for New World to acquire.
Santa Barbara in France was a huge deal.
Really?
Yes.
There we go.
But I think it was an hour show at the time, and they stripped it to a half hour. And they cut it and just ran. I just remember when that deal closed, it was in the tens of millions of dollars. It was just a big deal. Yes. But yeah, it's and that and then we talk about Crime Story and Tour of Duty and New World's foray into network television. At the end, it just makes me think of some titles. I did see Heather's. But this is, I mean, that's a sad story. This is, Heather's coming out right at the time when New World was just going to turn itself over, and they just had to service the film. There was no, there was no desire to really put any money behind that film from a marketing standpoint.
I remember when we spoke to Daniel Waters, who wrote Heathers, and he talked about how producer Denise DeNovi wrote her own check to keep an ad in the paper for the second week because there was going to be no marketing. But you're talking about Australia, so there is a big arm in Australia. In fact, New World tried to really start its own Australia division there. That's why we got The Punisher. They made that through Australia, trying to use the tax credits of Australia to make stuff. Did you know anything about the Australia? What was going on with them
Well,
trying to?
we sent someone down there who's I can't remember his last name. His first name was Ray. I can't remember his last name. And he went to run that operation. And basically, it's hard to run a full distribution operation in another country with all foreign films, meaning they're all US film going to Australia. But what basically it did is we contracted with a local distributor and bought a portion of their operation, not in terms of owning it, but basically we were going to, as New World, and I forgot the name of the company, we were going to have a certain portion, 40, 50% of their distribution. So it was their staff, our marketing spend. So it was almost a rented distributor, if you will. We oversaw the marketing, we determined the marketing spend, we sort of ran that, but the labor, the people who were on the ground doing it, weren't on our payroll, they were on a third party payroll. But this was all about just the theatrical and the video. It wasn't about the television piece. And it was looking at Australia, and we did the same thing in the UK because it was just going to be more profitable that way. When you're licensing a film for a fixed fee to a local distributor, they're taking on risk. And if you're giving up risk, you're also giving up something economically. If you can retain risk, you're retaining the upside. And New World saw it both in Bill Shields saw it both in Australia and the UK. We were better off retaining the risk rather than licensing to a third party, running the marketing ourselves, paying the bills, renting a distributor for a fee, basically. And but someone needs to be on the ground when you're doing that. With a small, I think each of them had a staff of three or four. I mean, it didn't need to be a big operation because it was a rented distributor. And basically they were the marketing team and overseeing the spend and the decisions.
I was just going to ask you, especially talking about risk. You talked about how, in the 80s, there was this incredible, insatiable appetite for content. You had distribution, video stores, HBO, Showtime, television, everything. So New World Pictures is a distribution company, and it's just a matter of getting that content out there. But at some point in the public's eye, it becomes saturated, and people start becoming more selective. They have. At first, they're consuming all this content that they never had access to before, and eventually they're going to start being saying, I don't want to focus on these movies. I don't want to watch that movie. I don't want to watch that television show. I want to be a little more choosy in what's being offered to me. Did you see that trend start to happen with New World,
Nope,
or was it?
because I don't think that was the case back then. It didn't matter what the public wanted. What mattered was that the companies had everything, the platforms. The theaters had to have every film. The video stores had to have every film. HBO and Showtime, if one didn't, the other did. It was a matter of they had to have everything. It's different, but somewhat similar to Netflix today. And I'll just draw one corollary to it, which is Netflix has to have one of everything. What Netflix, and I'm going to jump forward 35 years, I promise to go right back.
You're
It's all
fine.
right. Netflix realized before anyone else that the streaming model would succeed if it followed what magazines have known for 100 years. The people renewed their subscriptions if there was at least two sections in the weekly or monthly book that they really wanted. They didn't renew the subscription for all 100 pages of whatever the magazine, whether it was Time or Vogue. There were at least two sections they would keep renewing. So Netflix went into this and said, we don't have to have every documentary. We just have to have enough so that the documentary people won't cancel their subscription. And the same with Adam Sandler movies and on and on and on. So this is what, and this is still part of the Netflix model. And it's as long as they stick with it while they'll continue to succeed. Well, if you go back to the video stores and HBO and Showtime and everything else, that Showtime was in the subscription model back then. We sort of don't look at it that way. They weren't specifically looking at the rating of each film that they acquired. They were making sure that they had a bundle of content that everybody would say there was something there that I want. Whether it was low eyeballs or high eyeballs didn't matter. They didn't do the math based on, only 2% of the Showtime subscribers watch that. Yes, but are those 2% keeping their subscription year round? And so it wasn't a matter of too much content and the public How can you say today they had too much content 35 years ago?
Sure,
You know,
sure.
look at what we have now. And so, no, it wasn't too much content. You looked at the video stores and you'd see just, you would, yes, new titles, you'd see a rack and you'd see 40 of the same title if you went to Blockbuster. But then you moved away from the recent releases and you saw one or two of each. They didn't want any store to be in a situation where you came in and have somebody say, "Sorry, we don't carry it," because then you might not come back. So the customer coming into the store is just like a subscriber, and so no, it wasn't that. Of course, consolidation is what sort of led to a little more sanity in the production and revenue area. You know, BSB and Sky merged. HBO and Showtime stopped giving blanket output deals. And on and on and on. And there were a lot of losses, more from companies like Weintraub and De Laurentiis, who went public and then tanked. And so people became a little more business focused, if you will.
And just to scoot back to you were talking about the way that they were raising money through Wall Street. New World did raise some money through Wall Street. They had a Balcor film investment where they had people buy into this investment. And it was a huge money raising thing is how they then made a bunch of the movies that they were making. As you said, they were trying to make movies and distribute them. That was their focus. Do you think that that had a sort of negative effect over the company? Because as you said, it sort of starts to fall apart.
Well, a lot of those were done. I mean, Disney did Silver Screen Partners 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 for a while. There was a time, when people weren't satisfied with 10 and 15%, returns in Wall Street, and they wanted something higher risk with better potential. And so, Balcor is just one of many different slate financing. The pitch back then was, if you invest in one movie, you're rolling the dice. If you invest in 10, of course, it's got to be profitable because the losses offset the wins. But no different than Disney with Silver Screen Partners. When a studio says, "We want you to invest in our movie because we don't want to put up our own dough," that should be the message right at the beginning. I mean, I never got it because, and it was back to the analogy with the oil refiners. They just wanted a source where they're going to take distribution fees and marketing fees and overhead fees and all of this and make their profit on the distribution and let someone else take the production risk. That's the nirvana for any film distribution company. And so, Balcor, where New World made its biggest profit, I think it was 89, was when it looked like it was going to go bankrupt, and it bought back its bonds at about 50 cents on the dollar. And I don't know, it's $150 million or $200 million. They made a $100 million profit, and my number is going to be off a little bit, I don't know, on just buying back their bonds at 50 cents on the dollar. Because they look like if they're going to go bankrupt, the bondholders are going to get zip. And they managed to buy the bonds back by, the New World stock, went way down for a point. It was a couple dollars. It had gone down. It was very volatile in 88, 89. Again, I don't remember the exact numbers. And it looked very dicey. And that shored up the balance sheet and then really set the company up to be sold.
And also at the time they had also sold because they had purchased Marvel in 87 and then they sold Marvel off as well, right?
Marvel came in and out. It was just whatever you can try to build a company. Again, I never felt that they had a plan to want to be in business forever. They had a plan to get it to a point. Now, I don't know that they had a date for that. I never sat and asked, but there was going to be an exit strategy. They were smart in 1983 to say, remember when they bought, and you know this better than I do probably, when they bought New World, they just bought the distribution shell. They didn't buy
Correct.
any of the content, all the films that stayed behind. They just because they saw they didn't need the films. They just needed a distribution operation and the money to start funding it.
Right. Yeah, they had some of the library for a first couple years. they had access to it because Corman stayed on to actually produce films for them initially. And then I think they felt like we're good, we don't need Corman anymore. And then they wouldn't release his movies and they sued and he sued and then he ended up walking away with his library. So, but yes, they are essentially when they bought it, they did buy it just to have a turnkey operation. That's what they were really looking to get, 100%.
As a distributor.
Yeah. Do you know, like, because you said like you always had the impression that they were looking to eventually sell it. Do you know what first made you think that, or was there a moment where you were that
No, I
realization?
think it's a little bit more in hindsight when you look back and see the trail of decisions and how things were done, that I don't think Bob Raimi was brought in to make Academy Award-winning films. They were never in a position that they were going to make studio level investments. It was how can we build this? The TV business was much more of a business than film, much more predictable. TV business is more like making shoes. You make a sample. If nobody buys the sample, you don't manufacture. You make a pilot. If nobody buys it, you move on. Losses limited. Film, you 100% is spent before you even with some pre-sales, before you really know how you're going to do it. So the move into TV, I think, was more into sh trying to show again a stable, sellable business.
When you started and you're in international sales, do you remember the first, did you just sell a bundle or did you sell a particular
When you
film?
say
What
you,
was
I
your
wasn't a salesperson, so I'm speaking of you as the
I'm
division.
sorry. Yes,
Yeah,
yes.
the division. In some cases, you're selling film by film. In some cases, you're selling slate. In Germany, especially, Andreas Falschier was the name of the president of the German company. I'll remember the company in a minute. It was a 40 picture slate that was sold in 1988 because they wanted a guaranteed source of content. New World wanted guaranteed pricing, and so those slates would be tiered. There'd be a certain number of films that would be a certain level of budget or star, and you have three or four films in the slate. Other times it would be a single film. It just depends. You go into some countries, the buyer is just saying, I'm only looking for horror films, or I'm only looking for action adventures. Now on domestic syndication, just to flip it, on almost all syndication, these were slates. The numbers weren't big enough that you're going to sell, Channel 26 in Des Moines a single film. The friction is too much. So there in syndication, even internationally, you put these together in 10 to 20 film slates, and you try to put the slate together in a way that they all made sense. You're not going to give a horror and a romantic comedy and put them all together for late night. You put it together in a way that would sell well, and you put big, medium, and small. The only problem with slates from a finance standpoint is there was no allocation in the contract as to how much each film was worth. So then, back in the offices of New World, you had to somehow allocate for the profit participants what their slice of each slate was. And that got murky. And you had to have methods that appeared, at least on the outside, to be relative to what was there. Are you basing it on its domestic theatrical revenue? Are you basing it on TV ratings? Are you basing it on cassette sales? Are you basing it on total revenue? And of course, in audits, a profit participant would say, your method's not fair, the different method works. And so slates are messy. They still exist today. But slates were messy. But this is just a rock and roll time. You just move fast and grab the dough where you could.
Do you remember like the first deal that you participated in when you were there?
No, I mean
There was
it's.
just too much going on.
I was again since I'm not in the front of sales. A gentleman named Jonathan Weisgall worked with Bill Shields in terms of on the theatrical side. Jim McNamara headed the television side internationally. They would cut the deals. They would be on the first phase. If I got involved in the deals, it was fixing them. Because something went wrong, and it's like get on a plane and go talk to these guys. And the one in Germany stands out the most for me. But that was also when New World was closing down. But it was also giving these guys the tools they needed to make sure that they could make the right decisions in terms of what to sell and how much to sell it for.
Right.
But it was constantly changing. I'd say a lot of people, if they looked at their job description every year, even they may not have the same title, the job description would keep changing because the company was still evolving. It got big enough, the building on Sepulveda, that New World had the whole building. They outgrew the building and moved the entire accounting department. That wasn't me because I was part of the international, financial operations. The entire accounting department moved to one of the twin towers in Century City and sublet a whole floor. And they all moved out of that building. So, because it just didn't matter. They weren't relevant to what was going on. But it was a little bizarre having your entire accounting and finance team, a few miles away from the operation. But they
Sure.
just kept growing. Growth was the key thing. Grow, grow,
Right.
grow. It just didn't matter. And they ended up the it was what 1640 and 1440 Sepulveda. They had one building completely, and then they leased another floor of the building a block away down the street. Just kept growing.
So we've talked to a few people that have been through New World and were there at the end. And at the end, we just really mean like when it sold in the late 80s to Ron Perelman, it still
Right.
continued on. But you were there, still working at the company.
I left right at is it was in June of 1990. I left when the Perelman deal was done and was just about to close. It was a
Okay.
week. It was weeks away. So yeah, I was there through all of that. The Peretti bid. One of the interesting parts about that is Peretti came in and did a lot of due diligence on New World, and ultimately, and his deal was going to be backed by Credit Lyonnais. His deal fell apart. He got into all sorts of trouble, and Ronald Perelman, McAndrews and Forbes came in, and they relied on the work that the due diligence that Peretti had done. And I remember being in a meeting with Perelman's representative. His name may have been Bill Bevins, but I can't remember. He just liked scotch and peanuts at 5 o'clock, I remember. But we're sitting in this office, and it's in the president's office at New World. And he pointed over at a corner stack of papers like this. And he said, "See that those papers over there? That is shit. You want to know what that is? That's the due diligence from Peretti. It's all shit. They bought the company and found out the things they assumed about it were wrong." And so when Perelman, Perelman's company, McAndrews and Forbes, had it, look, they survived, they did fine. But what they thought they had and what they actually got were different because they didn't do their own due diligence. They relied on Peretti's due diligence and looked at it. And for whatever reason, it wasn't what they thought it would be. But they never had any intention, as you know, to keep the film division. And it was all about television, just that was that. It was
Because
very quick.
Perelman owned like several TV stations, right? That was also part of
Yeah,
his
he may have a
thing.
time. I mean, cl clearly that was the big growth engine. They bought all these small television stations around the world, and then they caught a moment, which was, Fox decided that it was going to go get the NFL, and
Right.
owning these television stations would be huge in terms of making that happen. And so that was a nice flip, if you will, for Perelman.
Yeah.
And that
Now,
was that.
real quickly though, because you've already touched on a little bit of it, like Heather's sort of being not, it was at a time when things were going badly and for the theatrical division of New World and stuff. Had you kind of seen, and you knew that they were trying to just sell it at some point, or maybe in hindsight, but were there signs where you were like, oh, I don't think business is going so hot? Were there signs that you
Well, sure, when
remember?
the company's teetering near bankruptcy and they're, 50% back on the bonds, you wonder, what's going to go on here?
That certainly is not a great financial position to
You
be
have
in.
300 employees and the films are still going out and the bills are still getting paid and no one's getting laid off in any significant number. I mean, a few people would. here and there, but it wasn't some giant cost cutting. Now, as soon as the acquisition pieces began, then that was a, discussions. That was a different story. And Dino De Laurentiis had also taken a look at doing that. Bob Ramey was involved with Dino in trying to help set up his offer. So you had different segments within the company actually trying to do different things. And of course, nothing better than a bidding war. It was timing. I don't know what it was that sparked the now we should do it, but clearly, they picked the right moment. I remember seeing Larry Cuppen about 6 months later in a restaurant during the day, as casually dressed as anybody could. He had shorts and a Hawaiian shirt on. I'd only seen this guy's suit and tie. I said, "Larry, you're looking so casual." He just smiled and said, "Yep, got no one to try and impress anymore." And he and Harry each left with, again, this is public information, their piece was about 20 million each. Ramey's was about 8 million, and this is $1990. And I don't know what Roger Burlidge either sold when he left or held on to. I, don't know about that, or whether he, what he did. But I know the 2020 and 8 for the three key guys was a number. But there were dozens and dozens and dozens of people who had stock options in the company. The company was, I would say, generous in that way, that a lot of people had small pieces and benefited from it, and so weren't terribly hurt in that way. Obviously, they say that the musical chairs is people keep moving around a lot, but we forget when we use that phrase musical chairs, there's one chair removed each time. And when you start to have an industry that's consolidating, it really is musical chairs and not just shifting around. There's one less chair. And we would see that some people who just say, who ended up with hard times, that it's going to happen in this industry.
And from that, did you have stock options? Did you have any stock at the
Yeah, I was at a
company?
level, I think most vice presidents did. Yes.
Did that help you move on? Because you
No,
and
I left on my own. Bob Sharon and I, who Bob was president of domestic, he and I decided to form our own distribution company. We had backing for the P&A, and so we went off on our own on a frolic and a detour.
Studio 3, right? Studio 3
Yes,
film.
and that had about a 24-month life.
You produced two films, right?
Well, we acquired two films. Our model was going to be the quintessential distribution company. No risk at all. We were just solely going to be a distributor for hire. But one of the things that we offered, because by then risk capital was beginning to ask producers who's distributing your film. It wasn't like The Killing Time 3 or 4 years later. People started to wise up. So we were actually agreeing to distribute films before they were made based on certain talent or budgets. And we would give a locked distribution agreement to a producer who hadn't finished raising his funds, his or her funds, so that distribution deal would then open up financing opportunities. And it started to, the reasons we fell apart are the subject of another podcast for another day, but part of it had to do with the first Gulf War. Dried up risk capital right at that moment we had committed to releasing our first film, and it there was a domino effect for us. But look, if you haven't closed the door on at least one company, you can't really call yourself truly someone who involved in independent film on a lifelong basis. You have to shut the door somewhere.
Those two movies, by the way, that was Rich Girl and Popcorn, right? Those are the two movies that you
There we
guys.
go. But even Popcorn was an example of a typical independent film. It was a horror film that wasn't quite enough horror, and a comedy that wasn't quite enough comedy, but it was a fun film. And Bob and I would had a long discussion of how do we market it as a comedy or a horror film. He won that argument.
So, I know we're a little bit over time, but we've been, we talk a lot about Roger Corman on this podcast,
Right.
obviously. And he passed a few years ago, and we've been thinking a lot about where the next Corman may come from. And wanted to see what you thought about that. I know how many you've spent so many years not, I mean, obviously you were at New World, but you spent so many years like at American Film Market. And just have seen how the whole market has changed. Do you see that there could be another Corman that would come around and set up business like he did?
No, I, you know, the closest you can get is Jason Blum, but you know, even the business is different. Look, I follow auto racing also, and not to segue too far. 30 years ago, auto racing was almost, they would call it, even at the top level, was IndyCar and NASCAR, run what you brung. If you could put together a car in your own shop and bring it to a race track at the highest level, the Daytona, whatever, if you could qualify, you could make the race. Today, that's not the case. If you're not part of a huge operation with hundreds of people, you can't do that. Film was the same way when it came to distribution back then. You could do, if you could put it together in a small level, you didn't need scale. You could just survive at a small level. You see that a little bit, but Roger was just so unique in what he did. And there was also a marketplace for what Roger did. Now, if you see it, if you see people doing this, they're going to land on YouTube. And with aspirations to get out of YouTube. Roger didn't have those aspirations. Roger said, this is where I want to be. And so, you know, now, it's, and that's sort of like your Uber driver in LA is, I'm not an Uber driver. I'm a, you know, you name it, you know, a writer, director. Everybody wants to be somewhere different. What made Roger successful was first, clearly his eye for talent at every level, in front of and behind the camera. And then his lack of ego from a standpoint of saying, this is my spot. You know, Roger made a studio movie. It was in the late 80s, 90s. It was at Fox. It was a period piece with a time travel in it. I forgot the name of it now. They spent like $9 or $10 million on the film. It was a disaster, and it looked like a disaster. I wish I could remember the name of it now. You guys should know this.
Is it Frankenstein Unbound? You're not thinking of
Yeah,
that, is
I
it?
think that may be it.
Yeah, because there is time, a bunch of time travel in that
Yes.
one.
Okay.
I did see part of that movie. Because they tried to shop it to us at Studio 3. They didn't want to release it. We watched three acquisition movies a week, and that was one of them. Fox literally didn't want to release it. But it was a typical Roger movie. Someone was about to get hung, you know, they dropped the noose, and you could see the braces coming, you know, the harness come up in the shoulder. It didn't matter. This is a Roger movie. But somebody at Fox committed $8 or $9 million to this, and they got a Roger movie. He was comfortable in the spot. You know, I knew Roger. He was on our board of directors. I had lots of time with Roger. You know, listen to him, sweet, soft-spoken. You know, just a gentleman. You know, all the way through. And you know, look, you can't be in his role without an ego. But what I say when I say that, he didn't have an ego that said, "I need to be at the next level." He was good at what he did, and stuck to that knitting, if you will. But where can someone come up? I just haven't seen that opportunity. Where is there a spot in an industry where someone who says, "I can recognize talent," and I'm comfortable at the lower end of the budget, and there's a marketplace for what I'm going to make, and I'm not going to leave that space, you know. And that's the last piece of it. I'm not going to leave that space. I don't know how you do that.
Because I mean, the way you've seen this happen, how movies are sold and how they get distributed, all that's changed. It's had such a huge sea change in how we market and distribute things. It's a challenge. Why do you think Jason Blum might be the
Well,
only
I
one
only
that
look at
can?
it because here's someone who started at lower budgets, an individual. It's his vision. For Roger, everything about New World is Roger's vision. Yes, he brought in smart people. He brought in creative people. You know the list better than I do of the people who went through New World.
Sure.
And I only mentioned Jason because from afar, I admire what he's done. He started at a certain point. But of course, he's growing beyond that. He's not satisfied. That's an unfair phrase. He's choosing not to stay where his roots were only at a certain budget level, a certain type of film. But he's also a creator. And if someone says, "Do you want to play in a bigger sandbox?" There aren't too many people that say no. And so, Roger was offered the bigger sandbox only once by Fox. Frankenstein, Unchained is
Unbound,
Unbound.
unbound.
Yes. And that was okay. He said, "Sure, I'll play in the sandbox," but that was that.
Yeah. This was great. Jonathan, this was so awesome. Thank
Yeah,
you so
thank you
much
so
for
much.
taking the
Appreciate it.
time. Do you guys have any questions before we sign off? I just want to be sensitive to time here because I know we went over a little bit what we said we would.
No, I'm good. I mean,
Okay.
this was incredibly informative and a
Yes,
perspective that
thank
we haven't
you.
had on this podcast. So
Really?
this was really
Yeah.
great.
Yeah, this was so
Very
great,
cool.
so
Thanks.
interesting. And thank you so much for sharing your perspective. This was so cool. I
Well,
hope we can maybe talk to you again at some point down the line.
hope so. And now I'm going to have to become a frequent listener of the podcast.
And that's it. That's our interview with Jonathan Wolff. Thank you so much to Jonathan for joining us for this interview.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think, Ryan, you said at the top that this interview was a different perspective than we've had with other interviewees, which
For
is not to
sure.
say
Yeah.
that we haven't thoroughly appreciated talking with
Of
everyone that we've
course. Of
talked with on this
course.
podcast, but to get the behind the scenes and kind of understand the formula that goes into choosing which movies you're going to make and the finan how you make sure that you're keeping everything afloat from a finance standpoint was really insightful. And I think you and I, Ryan, we talked a lot back in the day about New World Pictures and trying to understand, why don't they exist today? And they made all these movies, and yes, not everyone was a hit, but they had some really big hits. And why aren't they around today? And it was really great to hear the inside financial perspectives and kind of understand the inner workings of the business of New World, not
Right,
just the
right.
output of the movies that they made.
Yeah, and as we reveal in this episode, as you've heard it, we have spoken to a former New World Pictures president, Roger Berlidge. So that interview was forthcoming, but we just thought this was such a great insight to how New World worked, and we're hoping to speak to even more people that worked behind the scenes. Behind the scenes, like at the actual company, just to see how this all happened. As Mark said, we've just always been curious, why were they deciding on things? How did it work in the actual offices? And so thanks again to Jonathan for filling us in and educating us. We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, check out all our other interviews at our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. That's where you can find all of our episodes, interviews, articles, T-shirts, buy a T-shirt, and we'll see you next time at the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
Are you a film fan who loves the ultimate home video experience? Look no further than The Disconnected. Your host, Ryan Verrill, is your go-to source for the latest and most accurate information on home video releases, exclusive interviews with industry insiders and filmmakers, and has established a thriving community where every film and physical media enthusiast feels welcome. From hidden gems to blockbuster hits, The Disconnected brings you insider knowledge and a welcoming space to share your love of cinema. Watch every Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific for the live announcements show and follow The Disconnected on social media to stay updated. Subscribe to The Disconnected on YouTube or on the podcast provider of your choice, and dive into a world where every movie night is an adventure.